This is a production of Cornell University.
So that we can get started in time. So I'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. And if there are no objections, I'll move the land acknowledgement up just to give folks a few minutes to arrive before we do the roll call of the group. Any objections to that? We'll go ahead and start with the land acknowledgement just to give folks a little bit more. Cornell University is located on the traditional homeland of the Gayakona, okay? The Cuban Nation. The Gayakona are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy perceived the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayakona dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayakona people, past and present, to these lands and waters. And now I will turn to Casey, who will do roll call for us, please.
Ian Akashola.
Here.
Valerie Amer. Marcy Denda.
Oh, sorry, here.
She's here.
She's here.
Up there. She's up there at the right.
Yeah, is our sound on?
Yeah. Yeah. Hi.
Can you talk again? We don't hear you.
Yep. Oh, you hear me now?
Uh-oh.
I'm here.
Deborah now?
Did you say Deborah Howell?
Okay.
Okay, perfect.
So it might be, you might have an audio issue. Now we know.
But she's muted. That's what.
Oh, I just fixed it. It's all right. Richard Bentle?
Yes.
Stephen Cady?
Here.
Nicola Dana? Yves DeRosa?
Excuse.
Jacob Veit?
Here.
Brandon Fortenberry?
Here.
Tom Spox?
Here.
Preston Hanley?
Here.
David Heiner?
Here.
Deborah Howell?
Here.
I'm here.
Caroline Levine?
Here.
Manaya Lewis? Annalie Anonia?
Here.
James Richards? Damien Sharp?
Here.
Jessica Withers?
Here.
All right, I will now call for any late additions to the agenda. Yes, Richard.
We need a clock.
That's not a late addition to the agenda.
Oh, sorry. We're a little early.
That's okay. Hey, come on in. We're almost to your spot there, so we're good.
From you, Brandon?
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
We're just getting through a few items and then we'll get to you, if that's okay.
Sure.
So, side of the clock, if we have any other late additions to the agenda? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to approval of the minutes. I would entertain a motion to approve or any motions to amend the main minutes from November 2nd.
Move to approve.
Richard has moved to approve, seconded by Duncan. Any objections? Seeing none, the meeting minutes from November 2nd will be approved. With that, we'll move into our open forum. So, look, perfect timing.
There you go.
And I would like to welcome our guests this evening. Very excited to have them. President Martha Pauli and VP Joe Molina will be talking to us a little bit about some of the things there that we would like to hear about. We'll have an opportunity about at the end to ask some questions. I did receive one question in advance, but other than that, it will be a free open forum. So,
okay.
With that, I'll turn it right over to you.
Well, hello. It is really, really great to be in person. I haven't done this in person in a long time, as I know you haven't either. I know it's been an extraordinarily difficult time for everyone. We've all experienced significant stress. But I'm really just awed by how well the Cornell community came together, despite social and political upheavals, despite all the public health challenges. Some of you are dealing with child care or elder care or schools opening and closing, illness, in some cases even loss of family members. And then, of course, about a week and a half ago, the bomb threat and then the shelter in place. It has been a lot for everyone, and I really thank you all for all you do. And as I have in the past urged people to be gentle and kind and flexible with each other and with yourself. Remarkably to me, while dealing with all of this, our community did move forward, continued its core mission of teaching and research and engagement. And so I want to spend just a minute or two recognizing some of the remarkable work, first by our staff, as I noted to the staff in my comments to them last week. The staff just kept everything running, our academic departments, our labs, our libraries, our offices, our residence halls, our dining halls, and of course the Cornell Coronavirus Testing Laboratory, our roads, our vehicles, our gardens. I mean, really, this place would not function without the staff. And so because of that, I am just really pleased and wanted to share with you, in case you weren't at the staff speech last week, pleased with the news that Forbes, now I'm not a big fan of rankings, you guys know that up front. I think U.S. News and World Report, for example, is very pernicious in its metrics. But there are some rankings that are based on reasonable metrics, and Forbes every year goes out and surveys. They survey 80,000 Americans working for employers with at least 500 employees, and they ask them to rate them on things like safety of the work environment, competitiveness of compensation, opportunities for advancement, and how likely they would be to recommend their employer to others. And Cornell came out, they ranked by state, and Cornell was number two in the entire state of New York. And I just really appreciated this because we have such wonderful staff. I also want to know who were we beat out by. We were beat out by Regeneron, which the CEO is a Cornell alumnus. So, you have to lose. I also want to highlight and acknowledge some of the faculty accomplishments this year. I do that with a little bit of trepidation because I know for many, the past year, year and a half has been really, really difficult or even impossible to be as productive as normal, and that's okay. Be kind to yourself. I say that to everyone, faculty, staff, and students, the pandemic won't last forever. But with that said, I want to note, first of all, that last year, FY21, the year that ended July 1 of this year, across the university, across the whole university, so all three campuses, our faculty submitted a record $3.3 billion in grants, and they received almost $1 billion in grant funding. Now, you know, grants aren't directly relevant in every field. They're not the only measure of academic success, but they do matter, and these numbers are, I think, doubly impressive given that these submissions and this received funding happened during the pandemic. I also want to congratulate a number of our faculty members who were elected to national academies this year. That is really, in many fields, the highest recognition you can get. We had two new members of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, Roberto Sierra and Michi Yu. Two new members of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Maureen Hansen and Bernice Braxton. 1.5 new members of the National Academy of Engineering, Jeff Hessler, an emeritus professor and former dean, Lance Collins. Two new members of the National Academy of Science, Anurang Agarwal and Maureen Hansen. And then just a few weeks ago, Hume Hemmings at Weill Cornell Medicine was elected to the National Academy of Medicine. We also had 3 assistant professors who got National Science Early Foundation Early Career Award, National Science Foundation Early Career Awards, and another faculty received an earlier career award from the Department of Energy. Now look, the list of prizes go on and on and on. I'm not gonna read them all. I am gonna tell you about one more though, because it is extremely prestigious. Scott Emmer, who is the Frank H.T. Rhodes Class of 1956 Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics, and also director of the Weill Institute for Cell and Molecular Biology, was awarded the Shaw Prize in Life Sciences and Medicine this past summer. This is for Scott's discovery of endosomal sorting complexes required for transport, or the escort pathway. This award, the Shaw Prize, is often called the Nobel Prize of Asia. It's a very, very prestigious prize, and so I do want to congratulate Scott and really all of our faculty who have been honored with a range of prizes this past year. And finally, while I'm recounting academic distinction, let me note that amongst our graduate students, we had 2 Ford fellowships, 3 Mellon dissertation fellowships, 1 doctoral student who received a 2-year, $240,000 National Science Foundation grant, 3 doctoral students who won Facebook fellowships, 1 doctoral candidate who won a Women in Triticum early career award. I actually don't know what that is. I should have looked that up. And 44 new NSF GRFP awardees who joined a campus community, about 200. So really, everyone here, despite all the challenges, we're moving forward, and I'm very, very proud of that. A few words about our incoming freshman class. If you've seen them on campus, they're so excited to be here. Most of them spent the end of their high school career learning remotely, and they're just thrilled to be here. We have 3,750 students. That's part of the growth that was planned with the opening of the North Campus residential expansion in CRE. They come from 69 countries and 49 states. Anyone want to guess? What state are we missing?
Montana?
South Dakota. Wyoming. So if any of you have connections to Wyoming high schools, we need to recruit there more next year. The class is 19.4% first generation. That has been growing steadily, and we're very proud of that. 55% women, 28% identify as underrepresented minorities. Nearly half are receiving need-based aid. And we also have, of course, a full complement of graduate students, 106 new med students, and 350 new students at Cornell Tech. Okay, a few other updates. I promise only time for questions, but I haven't been here in a while and I want to sort of update you on things going on. Sustainability is, of course, still a very key priority for us. I think everyone knows we have a goal of being carbon neutral by 2035. So here's another ranking. The Sierra Club. The Sierra Club, again, does a fairly objective ranking of universities based on energy, air and climate, transportation, and engagement. And Cornell, this is called the Cool School Ranking, and we are the number 4 cool school out of 312 that they rank. So I think that's pretty cool. Strengths are largely due to the many, many faculty who are affiliated with the Cornell Atkinson Center for Sustainability. And I want to give you just one example of faculty contributions because I personally think it's really interesting. Just last month, 4 Cornell faculty members, Aswar Prasad, Bob Howard, who many of you know from his years on UA, Anthony Ingrafia and Ari Jules from Cornell Tech testified before the New York State Assembly about the potential environmental harm that would be caused with a proposal to take carbon-based power plants and repurpose them to provide the power needed to mine cryptocurrency. Yeah. So that's a pretty interesting thing. If you go up to NCRE, you will see the commitment to sustainability. Those buildings have high-energy rooftop solar panels, high-reflectance roofing, 12-inch thick insulated walls, water-conserving plumbing and fixtures, state-of-the-art LED sensor, LED lighting with occupancy sensors. The roof, once they're open, they're going to be 5. 2 of the dormitories are open now. Once all 5 of those residence halls are open, those rooftop panels will generate 1.1 megawatts of electricity. That's going to provide more than a third of the electrical energy for NCRE. And I know the students, a few of you are students, are interested in this. We have embarked on a comprehensive university-wide 20-year strategic housing reinvestment plan, which will systematically address deferred maintenance in older residence halls, and it will begin as soon as the NCRE construction is complete. It's going to include both major renovations, like the one that we have planned for Walsh, and then updates in other buildings that need work, but not such extensive. Public safety. I know many of you know about the Public Safety Advisory Committee that I stood up about a year and a half ago after the murder of George Floyd. They came back last summer, and hopefully you saw my announcement on this with various recommendations. The most important was to develop and implement an alternative public safety and response unit to be operational within 4 years. We actually already have started on this. Student Campus Life has up and running this semester, a community response team, and that has 4 people who will be first responders to the kinds of non-criminal events and non-violent incidents that don't require a uniformed police officer. A student gets locked out of their dormitory, for example. You don't need a police officer to go to that. You can have the community response team. Beginning, we have an RFP out for a consultant who's going to think about how we expand this dual strategy approach to public safety with a police force and a community safety team. The other recommendations are also underway. One is community education on who you call, when you call 911 and get the police, and when you go to the community response team. And also a call to further diversify on CUPD, which we are, of course, going to work to do. I do want to note that the current racial and ethnic diversity of our police force mirrors that both of the local community and of campus police forces around the country. So that doesn't mean we won't try. Of course, we're going to try to go further. But I want to sort of level set and say it's not going to be easy. We're going to have to work really hard to further diversify. Okay, and then finally, a couple of updates on university finances, because I know that's something UA is quite interested in. So you all hopefully saw the announcement of the endowment returns. The endowment returns were extraordinary. You don't see endowment returns of a 49.9% vote. It's just unheard of, except this year. And this year you saw it all over the country. In fact, we were kind of in the middle of the pack for universities. The growth here is a result of a number of factors. One is this very strong market, but the other is a multi-year effort by our investment office to restructure those asset classes, to reduce fees, and to implement very rigorous risk monitoring and rebalancing frameworks. Now, I know some of you, I have a cold, I have tested negative multiple times for COVID, I do not have COVID, including just yesterday, I had a negative test. The endowment, I want to say a little bit about how endowments work, because not everybody understands how endowments work. So people tend to think of endowments as one great big pot of money. It's not. It's actually more than 8,000 separate accounts, and almost all of them are restricted to a particular use by a donor. So a donor might come in and say, I want to fund a professorship in anthropology. And what happens then is the earnings on that money, the interest, has to be put to fund the professorship, to pay for the salary and the research expenses of that professor in anthropology. Moreover, those gifts are intended to be permanent. So the money that's given to us has to be invested in such a way that it not only pays for the current purpose today, we use some of the earnings to pay for the salary and the research expenses today, and then we reinvest the rest so that over time it grows to cover those expenses, even net of inflation, and even in years where the endowment earning is less than inflation. So that's the first important thing. The second thing to note is that endowment returns are very, very volatile. 41.9% is unheard of. Last year, the rate was 1.9%, which was less than inflation. So to make sure that the endowment achieves what it's supposed to achieve, this permanent support, so that Cornell, which has existed for 156 years, can exist for the next 150, we're very disciplined in our spending. We spend basically about 5% each year. And only under the most extraordinary circumstances do we deviate from that. And we means the board. I don't get to make that call. My chief financial officer doesn't make that call. That is a decision that's made by our board of trustees. Last year was very, very unusual in that the board did believe the circumstances were extraordinary. The expenses associated with managing the endowment, or managing the pandemic, were extraordinary. And so they approved an increased payout for that 1 year. But in general, it's our responsibility and our board's responsibility to ensure that Cornell not only has the resources we need for today, but that we honor this commitment to have them for the future, really. And so we remain very disciplined in our payout rate. And all of that leads me to my last topic, which is, where does endowment come from? I think this is my last topic. And the answer is, for the most part, it comes from philanthropy. It comes from incredibly generous donors who feel that they benefited, but they're not all alumni, but the overwhelming majority are alumni who feel that they benefited from their Cornell education, and now they want to give back. So we're always working with donors, but every once in a while we launch a campaign, and a campaign is a period of time during which we seek to raise a lot of money. And a campaign has a theme, and our new theme for this campaign that we just launched publicly is to do the greatest good. This is something that Ezra Cornell said 156 years ago when he was trying to decide what would he do to make a difference. And he thought about a lot of options. He said, I want to do the greatest good and do it for posterity. And in the end, what he decided to do was found this university. And so in today's world, when I go out and speak with donors, I tell them we want to do the greatest good along three dimensions. We aim to educate students who are going to be leaders who carry the Cornell ethos forward. So that means committing to and supporting student access, so that we're always this university for any person. It means ensuring student wellness of mind and body. And it means building on a culture of education where we're always pursuing new ways to teach and experimenting with new ways to teach and pushing forward those new ways to teach that are most successful. Second, we aim to tackle some of the world's most challenging problems, moving from theory to practice and back again. That's something we really excel at here at Cornell. We have a remarkable openness to innovation. We have an unparalleled breadth and depth of expertise across critical areas, the kinds of areas like global sustainability, human and animal health, human creativity, social and economic equity, and technology and society. And finally, we aim to connect Cornell to the world through public engagement, through our international programs and our global reach, and of course, through our expanding presence in New York City, which complements what we do here in Ithaca. So, how much are we looking to raise? Goals are pretty ambitious. We're looking to raise $5 billion in the next 5 years. That includes $3 billion for Ithaca, $1.5 billion for Weill Cornell Medicine, and $500 million for the Cornell Tech campus. A key part of this, as I said, is student affordability. We want to raise $500 million, $500 million to increase affordability and access. And we have three specific goals, three things we can do if we raise that money. First, we want to increase the number of aided students by 1,000. Now, as I said, we're already growing because of the opening of NCRE. So we're growing by about 650 students, but then there's another 350 who would shift from unaided to aided. So we want to increase the number of lower and middle income students. Second, we want to reduce costs for middle income students. Students who come from the most resource constrained families already have no loan packages, but students from middle income families do take on loans. We want to reduce that by 25%, and that's one of the ways we're going to attract more low-income students to come. And third, for lower-income students who are already on no-loan packages, we want to replace at least one summer of the summer savings expectation. So students are supposed to go out and work, and there's an expectation that they'll pay part of their tuition. Replace that with grant, so that all of our students have the opportunity to have one educational engaged experience, or at least one, over the course of their career. It's a high bar. $500 million for affordability, $5 billion overall, high bar. But, you know, the way these campaigns work is before the public launch, we raise a lot of money sort of quietly, and we've already raised more than half the money that we need. Weill Cornell Medicine raised a huge grant, got a huge grant so that they now have debt-free education for medical students with financial needs. That came from the Star Foundation and also from Sandy and Jim Weill. I think everybody knows that we just announced a naming gift for the roughly the hotel school, which is now the Cornell Peter and Stephanie Nolan School of Hotel Administration. We had naming gifts for the Cornell Jed E. Brooks School of Public Policy, our new public policy school, and the Cornell Annis Bowers College of Computing and Information Science, the first school of computing in the country named for a woman. The new Atkinson Multidisciplinary Building, we have a large gift from David and Pat Atkinson. The Lab of Ornithology, Center for Conservation and Bioacoustics, a gift from Lucy Yang. We have a number of gifts from Tom Gold's mother to support affordability. I'm really excited about this campaign. I just believe that with these resources, we will continue to be one of the greatest universities in the world. I actually think it can be the model of a leading research university, precisely because of our commitment both to human diversity, that's any person's part, and the intellectual diversity in study part. So that is my update. There is a lot more going on, but I didn't want any time for questions. So happy to answer more about this or anything else.
So if I did the math right, you're going to raise $3 million a day, every single day for 5 years. Is that right?
$3 million a day, every day. Now that's
no, to get the $5 billion?
Well, we've already raised $2.5 billion.
Wow, I see.
We've already raised
this was only $1.5 million.
Only $1.5 million, yeah. So, and look, let's be honest. I mean, every dollar matters. We appreciate every dollar, but you need, the only way you get there is through some of these really big gifts. Yeah.
Question for President Paul. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Information. Very much appreciate it. Other questions for President Paul? Yes, Richard.
Arthur, thanks for coming, and I'm glad you're well. Sort of well.
I just have, I mean, yeah. You know, it's sort of crazy now that cold is such a big deal, right?
So, one of the questions we submitted, that first one, has to do with Cornell's involvement in China, which is a concern to many of us. And the question notes that there's been pretty strong correlation between Cornell's increasing involvement in China and increasing repression in that country and human rights and academic freedom. There are two parts to that question. One is, can you imagine any situation in which Cornell would decrease its involvement in China in response to increasing government repression in that country? I might note that that Harvard has started to do that, moving some of its programs from China to Taiwan in response, and whether Cornell is considering doing the same kind of thing. And the second is a more general question, because the Global Hub's involvement, some of the countries in which Cornell is becoming involved in Global Hubs have very repressive environments. Why doesn't the Cornell statement on academic freedom apply to Cornell programs outside the United States? So those were the two questions.
Let me step back, and just say a word about academic boycotts and what I actually even see as isolationism to spur. I think academic boycotts, I think staying out of countries, I think that is just directly at odds with our commitment to the open exchange of ideas, and for that matter, academic freedom. I think often the very close lines, very lines of communication that we most need to keep open get closed when you do that. And I think instead of polarizing calls for boycott, academic communities should be involved in productive discourse. I also think we have to respect the academic freedom of our faculty in making decisions about where they work. Now, we do stand by the protection of our students and their academic freedom at home and abroad. Our faculty oversee all of those programs, and all of our partners do agree to non-discrimination and academic freedom statements. I mean, we retain the right to cancel programs when there are concerns, and as you know, we have done that. I don't actually agree that our involvement has somehow been correlated with increase in repression. I mean, it's certainly the case that repression in China has been growing. But we've been in China for over 100 years. We've had been there through all different kinds of political times. And I think our mutual academic priorities right now in this moment of global stress, partnering with China seems to be more important than ever. We don't believe that any of the work that we're doing should aid government repression anywhere in the world. So I'm committed to being in all kinds of places because I think that those connections, faculty to faculty, student to student, are positive things for this world, not negative ones.
And if no one else has a question, I'd follow up. The point is not to regulate faculty research in China. The point is that we're involved in academic programs, which are increasing in scope every year, even while academic freedom and human rights is degenerating in that country. This isn't about individual faculty and their research. This is about the legitimation, the saying. For example, if you're saying that the Cornell statement on academic freedom applies to programs in Peking University, and that we wouldn't be there unless they complied with that statement.
I'm not that naive. What I'm saying is that I think that we have appropriate safeguards in place. You saw that we canceled a program in China just a few years ago when there was very direct negative backlash against our students because of academic freedom. What I'm saying is that I think that I trust our faculty who are overseeing those programs to provide an education for students that is valuable, and that keeping our students away from places like China at this moment is a negative. We need to have that kind of sharing. We need to have that engagement. I mean, I think this is just an issue on which you and I disagree about the benefit of doing it and the extent to which we trust our faculty to uphold the standards to an appropriate level, and if not full level. I mean, we may just need to agree to disagree on that.
Martha, I don't think faculty have capability of upholding those standards. They go to teach in Peking University, and you're saying they're going to uphold standards of academic freedom that the entire institution and regime violates. That's just not true.
I am not saying that the standards there are up to our standards. What I'm saying is that it is important for us to be engaged in China and to provide opportunities for our students to be there, that we have many faculty who want to be there teaching and who feel that they can uphold a sufficient standard and will pull out. And we have pulled out if we think we go beyond that standard. I think that isolationism is a disastrous strategy. That's my view.
Thank you. Thank you, Martha. I'd like to ask a question if I could, about the endowment that you talked about, sort of the campaign that you're looking at around the Do the Greatest Good. So you look to expand access to affordability, which is extraordinarily important. I greatly appreciate that. I advocate the need for the infrastructure that you're speaking to about that deferred maintenance, that focus on that. We have staff, students, and faculty working in environment. We're in a beautiful space right now. But the majority of people don't have these kind of experiences. And in fact, many of our residence halls are beyond disrepair at this moment. Many of our office spaces are beyond disrepair. Faculty are teaching in facilities that aren't able to meet the needs of what we need in the pandemic. So what can we do as we focus on this 20 years to ensure that in 20 years, we're not still 20 years
behind? Well, you raise an incredibly important point, Brandon, and I completely agree with you. Unfortunately, it's a problem for universities all over the country. We're spending more than $100 million a year on deferred maintenance, $100 million. So one of the things that the campaign can help us do is to relieve we're trying not to build too many new facilities, though there are some cases where we need facilities. So CIS, I mean, they're just packed to the gills. They can't hire the faculty they need because they don't have offices. They have students sitting in the halls and stuff. We've tried to really limit the number of new buildings. In fact, since I've been here, other than North Campus dormitories, which will bring us more students and bring us more tuition and help us, we haven't built any buildings. The focus on the campaign is primarily on people, not on buildings, except in these, you know, there are some cases where we really need it. But what that will do is free up funds so that we can continue to invest to the extent. But it's, you know, it's a really tough problem. There's just all these needs we have, and $100 million a year, even that's just barely making a dent in it. I acknowledge the issue.
Any questions? I guess something.
Hi, President Paul. My name's Duncan Kate. Sorry. yeah, totally good. I'm relatively new to the school, so I kind of trouble
you your name.
Yes, yeah. I'm an undergraduate student in Iowa, actually. Transition as well.
Great.
Just in my involvement in student assembly over really just this year so far, and I think engaging with the Cornell community from an undergraduate student perspective, I think it'd be remiss of me if I didn't mention mental health. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that is in the minds, in the hearts, and in the voice of a lot of students on campus. I'm just wondering, I guess, kind of both in reflection of really the threats of violence this past week, students' concerns with meeting academic obligations, which of course is naturally going to happen in any case. It's happening with COVID right now. It's happened for a while. If you could talk a little bit about your envision for next steps of improving mental health on campus.
Yeah. So again, this is a national problem. I don't go to a single meeting with presidents from other universities that they don't talk about the mental health crisis. I don't think I've been to a single assembly in 4 years where a student hasn't raised mental health. It's a national problem. We are investing really hand over foot. I mean, that budget has grown faster than any other part of the budget. There is a national shortage of therapists. That's why we hired Mantra, which is a telehealth service to help us fill that in. We have reduced, so I'm going to talk about this at Student Assembly later this week, but right now, if you have a crisis, you get in the same day. Otherwise, we've reduced the wait time to 7 days, which really, if you look at the national averages for therapists, it's 25 to 40 days. So we may not wait more than 7 days, but we're doing the best we can. Not more importantly. And there are another of other things we're doing. We're trying to hire more therapists of color. As I say, we have this telehealth facility. But we also did a very comprehensive, it's broader than mental health, it's mental wellness study that came out in 2020. Its implementation got slowed down a little bit, just like everything because of the pandemic. But it had a range of recommendations. Again, not just about providing therapy when a student is in crisis, but about ways to enhance mental health so that you don't get to that crisis. So it is sort of top of mind for all of us, and we're trying to do everything we can. Now, specifically with respect to the stresses of the bond scare and the shelter in place, I know that a number of students wanted classes canceled. It's not that simple. I mean, first of all, classes, you know, there's different sections, and if you cancel one day, they get out of sequence. There's labs that are sequential, and if you miss one, it's a problem. There's students. I mean, I got not as many, but I also got calls from students saying, please don't cancel classes. I prepared for this presentation. It's going to be more stressful if I put it off. Or, you know, I plan my time out, and I'm traveling from home. And that gets to the second point, which is one size doesn't fit all. There's a lot of students who didn't want classes canceled. And the third thing, of course, is it's not just students, right? I mean, this shook up everybody, but we can't tell all the staff to take a day off. Students need dining hall staff to feed them. Cornell Health has to stay open. Janitors have to be there. Custodial staff to empty trash and so on. So we're like a city, and a city just really can't close down every time there's this kind of an incident. That's why snow days are so rare. So it's not that we're not trying to be sympathetic. It's that we're managing a city, and we hope that, like, if individual students are really struggling, please reach out and get the help you need. But we can't just cancel classes for everyone. It's just not easy.
I appreciate your commitment to that. Thank you.
I have a question just about COVID generally.
Yeah, can you tell me who you are?
Yeah, my name is James Richards. I'm a chair of the COVID community.
Oh, okay. So you just said, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, there's probably an answer to this, but in regards to the COVID policy, like the masking and indoor restrictions and whatnot, is there, like, because we're in a good, pretty good place with COVID is on the campus, is there, like, a, you know, stopping point that the university is with?
I wish I could say yes. The problem is right now, both the CDC requirement and the state bureau law, this is New York State bureau law, requires indoor masking. So we're monitoring it, we're monitoring things. So even though on campus, it's really highly vaccinated right now, community transmission in Compton County is very high. So we're monitoring all that. So at the point at which we can legally do it, we'll be ready as soon as possible. I don't want to wear a poll. I have a poll more probably. But right now, we have to follow state law.
Time for one more question.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to say I really appreciate your statement about that space between what I call good and crisis, and how imperative that is with mental health and mental well-being. And I think it's one of the areas that need a lot of extra focus.
Yeah,
I greatly appreciate that. So, Jacob, please.
Yeah. Thank you.
I also appreciate, as everyone mentioned, you guys being here today. I think that you guys are doing phenomenal work, specifically in terms of the sustainability front. I'm studying environmental policy and governance here at Cal's, and sustainability is a chief issue of mine. So I'm going to ask a few questions just regarding sustainability, but more importantly, sustainable development for our campsite. You mentioned just a moment ago that Cornell really is a city in that sense. And in a sense, we are the heart of Ithaca, in my perspective at least. And so to understand how we're going to sustainably develop means that we also have to understand the ways that our infrastructure is compatible with the growing population of students. So what point does increasing the number of incoming freshmen actually impede on our ability not only to provide the greatest experience possible, but also make sure that our infrastructure is as sustainable as possible?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I don't think the extra 650 reaches a tipping point. But I also think that when you, and I don't think it reaches a tipping point on quality either. I mean, we're doing it in such a way. There are some undersubscribed schools, there are some oversubscribed schools. We're trying to manage that. The thing I think you have to ask is, where would those people be otherwise? So if we had fewer students, we would have less electrical need, less heating need, less cooling needs. But it's not as if those students wouldn't be living somewhere.
Perhaps I misspoke.
Okay, maybe I didn't understand.
So I think that it's less about the specific infrastructure, bridges, electricity, but more about the human infrastructure. So do we have enough personnel to support?
Well, we're going to hire more personnel. Part of growing these. Well, first of all, we're looking at staff across the university, because I don't think we're understaffed or overstaffed, but I think we can do some. There are staff who could be used better, who could be developing themselves better, who could be doing better jobs, and I think we want to be thinking about staffing broadly, and we've been thinking about that across all of our support areas. And we are thinking about hiring more faculty. We will be not thinking about. There is a commitment along with growing students to hire more faculty.
Absolutely. And on that point, just before we move on, sorry, Brandon. I think that also in terms of mental health and just also medical resources is also very important from the Cornell medical perspective here.
Wait until you graduate and try to get an appointment.
Right, I'm sure.
No, seriously. I mean, there's medical shortages. Yes,
right.
We track those numbers. We do the best we can. But unfortunately, medical care is just really
absolutely, yeah.
But I thank you. Thank you all. So nice to see you.
Thank you so much.
Stay well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Thank you, everyone, for your questions and participation. And I want to apologize for time-wise at this time of this, but I want to welcome our welcome to the University of St. And I'll let we do introductions for those representing from the Graduate Professional Student Assembly. I recognize Damian Sharp to introduce him.
Thank you, Brandon. I'm happy to be here with all of you. I'm Damian. I'm from the Policy School. I'll be a representative with the GPSA. I'm just really happy to join you. So thank you for having me.
Welcome, Damian.
Thank you.
After I reached out to a few members of the Assembly, there was one member who was unable to. That was Stephanie has had to step down due to commitment. So graciously stepped into the role. So very happy to have you. All right, we'll move on to the business of the day then. To upcoming visits. I do want to let everyone know that we do have these two that I've listed here actually confirmed. So the Public Safety Advisory Committee will be joining us on February 8th. Joanne DeStefano will be joining us, and we'll try to have an additional member from the committee join if possible. And then on January 25th, prior to that, the group that is working on Cornell's Earth Source Heating Initiative will be here to present to us. I had the honor to see a presentation at the leadership breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and it was fascinating just to hear what they're doing, how they're doing it, and they took some questions from the group, and it was really great, so I asked them if they would come here to do some follow-up.
I was actually at the borehole site last week, which was awesome. Beautiful parking lot right now. really remarkable. 7.25 lengths of the Empire State Building drilled directly perpendicular down into the ground. It is astronomical. It's crazy. And the amount of infrastructure that's going to be removed from the ground is so minimal. You driving by the site, you might not even realize it exists. And it should power, all goes as planned, to power the whole campus completely sustainably. Awesome. I can't wait for that.
Very cool. So I'm very excited. Thank you, David, to see them. I didn't get a chance to go and visit, so I'm glad that you were able to get there and check it out.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
Were you there? Yeah?
I was there. Yeah,
I didn't see you guys.
It was pretty cool.
Well, I look forward to them coming. At this point, actually, in January, they'll probably be a little further along, and they actually have some dates of when they might start breaking ground. So very excited to have them. So with that, we'll move forward to our assembly reports, and I'm going to make sure and acknowledge our student assembly first, who did defer last time, so please feel free if you have extra items from the previous to take time to give your report. So
yeah, of course. So just a few updates from the student assembly. So we had, I believe we all know about at this point, but we passed the Veterans Resolution. That was our SA Resolution number 32. We also had SA Resolution number 33, which was American Heroism in the Philippines. And that was related to ex-president of the university, Jacob Sherman. And that passed by the student assembly as well. We had a vacancy for our vice president of finance, which was vacant for about 3 weeks, as we filled it last meeting, by Valeria Valencia, who's our VP of finance. We had a report from PSAC, which is the Public Safety Advisory Council. One of our committee members, Connor Hodges, came to speak to us, who also spoke about creating a subcommittee of PSAC for the student assembly, so all student run, just to get more student feedback in that way. We had a few other things from our last meeting. So we had the athletics and physical education department come speak to us, which was Larry Faint, who came to speak about the byline process, where that is what the student assembly is spending most of our time doing right now, is getting through byline reports. Our final report is due last day of classes, and our last two hands will be this Thursday, This Thursday is our last week of hearings because it's Thanksgiving, so just working through those.
Any questions for the student assembly? All right, we recognize President of GPSA.
Yes, we had a meeting last night. We were supposed to have a presentation from President Polly, but as you guys know, she was feeling under the weather, so we rescheduled that for on the 29th. Basically, just mostly doing a little bit of housekeeping type things. We finally found a programming board chair, so we're very excited about that. So we can kind of start looking to do more events on campus, more programming for the graduate students. We brought up a resolution about establishing a vice president of finance. Our executive committee is currently just four members and without like a kind of like a budget or finance arm. And so we thought that would be important, you know, kind of mirroring the essay they have. And so we're looking to do that. And we won't be able to vote on that until the next meeting, but we're excited about that.
Any questions for Brexton? All right. Recognize Jessica with it for the employee assembly.
So, as the president alluded to, we had the annual president's address to staff on Friday, and we had 55 people attending in person and over 1,200 on Zoom, which I thought was a fascinating statistic. Before the president spoke, we handed out the Employee Assembly Appreciation Award, which goes each year to staff who've gone above and beyond in the past year in their support of the university. This year it went to Cornell's COVID-19 testing laboratory. And the president gave her address and took, I think, about a dozen questions. I did not count. So that was really great. Tomorrow, President Pollack and Vice President Mary Opperman are coming to the EA, and we have several questions already sent out to them. So we'll see how that goes. But those are the big things we've been working on.
I have a question for Jeff. 1,200?
1,200?
Yeah.
That's 1,200, right?
What?
Yes.
Sorry. That's amazing. I mean, what percentage of the staff is that?
You know, off your heart.
Probably in the 10%.
Range. Yeah.
Wow.
A little bit more than that. I think there's
8,000.
Yeah.
Well, that's really amazing.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
Mostly the assemblies offer hybrid. And I think the president's address has been hybrid for several years, but it was really great. It was good to see such a high number engaged in listening and asking questions.
Can I share one tidbit that just came in today? I've been shared with Jessica. Is before the event, colleagues from Weill Cornell Medicine and Cutter had called to ask for the link. They're 12 hours or 13 hours difference, but they followed up today to make sure that they got it so they could watch the video of it in their own watch party.
Oh,
so, way to engage with some of our colleagues.
Yeah. Any other questions for Jessica? All right, Dean DeRosa was not able to be here today. I don't know, Richard, if you have anything you'd like to report from faculty senate.
Yeah, well, we met last Wednesday. It was Martha did present, and much of the content was the same as today. And she did get some questions. We also heard. Or three resolutions were presented, two of them on standardizing tenure processes across the university. And then there was one resolution asking that due process be followed with respect to the global hubs, that they come before the Faculty Senate before any further expansion and creation of these programs proceed. Those three resolutions are being voted on right now electronically, so they're out. I guess as they say, they're in the field, and people are voting on them. Otherwise, it was the most normal Faculty Senate session we've had this year, which is an achievement, actually.
Any questions for Richard? We'll move to committee reports then. Recognize Jacob to give the executive committee report.
Yeah, so we met last Tuesday. We discussed briefly Robert's Rules, and Brandon's got this fantastic book here to keep us guided as it pertains to the rules of order, so we should never miss a beat. There should be no more confusion. And of course, we discussed briefly some of the questions and topics we wanted to talk about with President Pollack, which of course you all heard. but other than that, that I think really wrapped it up. It was a relatively short meeting. Of course, we also discussed attendance briefly. Again, attendance is a little bit low today, so let's make a note of that. But other than that, that is it.
Jacob, and just add on the Robert's Rule, we talked about how important Robert's Rules, the goal of Robert's Rules is to find the will of the people, and I take that statement from Richard, who I think was quoting someone in that as well, but I love that sentiment and the idea of what that means.
Well, it's in Robert's Rules.
It's in there, and that's, yeah. And that's the goal of Robert's Rules. It's not necessarily to stop someone from doing something, to make something else happen, but it's about finding the will of the people, and that's really what our goal here in these conversations are. And acknowledge that at times we may get into the weeds with that, as we did in that previous meeting. In the previous meeting, there were some back and forth around what the process and the procedure was, but that ultimately, if we look to get the will of the people, then that's the idea behind Robert's Rules. Yes, Tom?
Who's actually going to read that whole book?
It's just here in case we...
consultation purposes.
Mostly for show. I've perused it at times, and you know, some of the key phrases, it's a pretty big book. When we have
400 pages,
yeah.
It has a good index.
The will of the people is the ending. So if we have questions about, you know, particular procedures, it gives you kind of clear. I will say that I've read it, and I think a lot of the items have interpretation in them at any given moment, right? It's, again, as Richard stated, it's about finding the will of people. What are we looking to understand? What is the question? And Richard gave good advice in saying, you know, it's important to stop and just ask that question. And I will commit to doing that. As we get into those sticky moments, take a moment to pause it and ask, what is it that we're trying to figure out here? What is it that we are looking to achieve here so that we have a better understanding of goals? So it's not about stopping something from saying something so that we are admonishing them for a rule or things. It's about what is the good of the will of the people. We'll move on now to the Codes and Judicial Committee.
Okay. So it's obviously been a while since our first meeting, but I've had a number of conflicts, which is maybe anyone who can schedule a follow-up meeting, but there's currently a doodle poll which is still open. I think we give it till tomorrow evening, and then we'll have to schedule the meeting. And even if, for those of you who are on the CJC, even if you aren't able to attend one of the times, even just, you know, access the poll and then click that indicate that you can't attend at all, because I don't know that you actually need it and none of the times work for you. And then, you know, from the people that have answered, I'll determine whether we have a quorum, and then skip the meeting. Most likely it looks like it's going to be so far Tuesday of noon. So, after that.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions for Dan? Next up, Campus Welfare Committee. Deborah?
Hi, thank you. So we met yesterday. We were planning a meeting once a month, but at Brandon's request, we're going to meet twice a month. And that seems to make sense to me since we're having trouble sort of getting ourselves organized. We don't have any repeat committee members, so we're still working on that. We have several vacancies, actually more now, since one of our staff members is leaving the university, and so I will not be on the committee. So we have a lot of vacancies. At this meeting, we invited chairs of other similar committees on other assemblies and Brandon in to talk to us about what they've done as might relate to campus welfare. That was helpful for us. And then we decided, after that conversation, we decided to reach out to Michelle Arteby, who's the director of well-being for Cornell. And she's coming to our next meeting on the 29th, I think, to talk to all of us about what she's doing in the well-being space. And she said she tried last year to make a connection with this committee and was unable to do that, and hopes that we can be more connected with her this year, and we will certainly strive to do that. And that was it. It was a short meeting while we're trying to organize ourselves and choose what we're going to focus on. I did appreciate hearing in the questions about students and mental health, and I will definitely take that back to our committee for consideration. So thank you for whoever asked that question or made those statements. That's it for me.
Thank you, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah? All right, thank you. And then we'll turn to Ian on the infrastructure, technology, and the environment.
Site is meeting tomorrow from 5 to 6 over Zoom. And we are still soliciting feedback in regards to waste receptacle placement from individual members of the assembly as well as their constituencies. So if you have any input for me to pass along to the grounds and facilities management department on where areas you'd like to see more waste receptacles and specific locations, please pass this to me.
I'll get that to you tomorrow. I'll walk campus tomorrow. The class tomorrow isn't that important.
I was going to say I'd love to join that meeting if you're comfortable.
Yeah, sure.
So just sit in. So.
Awesome. Thank you.
James, looking to attend the meeting. Thank you. Any other questions for Ian? All right. Any liaison reports?
The Campus Planning Committee met on November 5th, discussed a number of things, including the ILR courtyard and landscape design process, which is underway, to try to build a more a space that facilitates more congregation and collaboration. So also discussion of the plant science building renewal project, which is receiving a large amount of funding from New York State. There's a presentation on the circular construction laboratory and some of the projects that it was working on now. And significantly to our discussion earlier today about NCRE, there were a number of members on the committee who were involved in the NCRE process who were actually quite critical of it. And there was some discussion of how to do better next time, essentially.
What were some of the criticisms?
Well, there seemed to be some discussion about the process that was used to select the developer and the merits of doing a building competition project, which Cornell has employed in the past. Essentially, the university will solicit proposals for a new building design and receive submissions and then weigh the merits of the respective submissions and choose a developer. The counterpoint to that, the challenges, there are that will require, on a national level, developers to travel to Ithaca and do construction in Ithaca, and Ithaca is not necessarily considered one of the major markets that developers frequently operate in.
Thank you, James, for that question. I'll recognize Duncan.
I wanted to first recognize if that's complete. I'll say for that, because it's not related to that.
Mine is.
Yeah.
Okay. What is the alternative to choosing a developer?
You mean as opposed to doing a...
As opposed to having an open solicitation, yeah.
I'm not 100% sure about that. I think with the NCRE, they did not use a competition.
They didn't?
They did not.
Oh, that I can see is a problem.
They selected... I don't have...
I misunderstood. I thought they did, and that was the problem.
No, there was discussion about returning to the model of soliciting... bids or proposals for design based on the competition process. My understanding from the meeting is that the university has shifted away from the competition process in choosing designs for buildings as of late.
So I'd just raise a point. I know I'm in a building that's worked very well since it opened in 1989, and the process of choosing the architects, anyway, was that people went around and visited buildings that had been built by various different architects, laboratories specifically. I don't know if that's whether that's useful as a suggestion in this context or not. It's architects, not developers.
Okay, did you have a question for Ian?
No, I had a separate report, from
Any other questions for Ian? recognized companies?
Yeah, so tentatively no like serious updates from the Ombud Search Committee, except for we do have candidates now. We're moving forward with the current candidates. I don't know how much I can disclose of that, except for to say that we found some. And likely we'll have another report, not, I guess, the week after Thanksgiving, what would be Thanksgiving break, when we are going to have our first real meeting and start discussing stuff. So stay posted, and I'll be getting them.
That's great to hear. Yes, Richard.
How many candidates?
I don't know if I can disclose it at this time, to be honest, but there's multiple.
Plural.
Well, we appreciate you taking that task on, and it sounds timing wise it's moving at a good pace.
Very good pace.
The goal is really to find someone that can take on that role by the end of the semester, so it's feasible to be able to reach that goal.
I think it's moving at a very good pace right now.
Any other liaison reports?
I was going to say, so I'm on PSAC, and I'm not exactly sure if I'm representing the UA or SA, but I could give you guys an update if you need that.
Love to hear.
But yeah, so for PSAC, we had a meeting with CPD. We were actually in the police department, so just like figuring out how their operations and everything work. And then basically just like looking at their facilities and stuff along those lines. And that was right actually Friday before basically the bombing attack, the bomb threat on Sunday. So we have a meeting this week, which I think we'll get some updates on basically how they were like responding to that situation.
Questions for Emily? Other reports? You know, the series of circumstances last week between the bomb threat and the police search on the following Tuesday hit all different areas, all different folks in all different ways. Folks that felt no impact and felt like, oh, everything was okay. The folks that ended up hiding in spaces for long periods of time out of fear and concern for life. And I know that was a very challenging week, so I encourage everyone to acknowledge that was. I had a moment today with some of my peers, and I felt everything was okay, and they had a pretty tough situation. I felt pretty stressed out, and ended up comically almost like setting the room on fire because they plugged in a plug that had they were in the dark, and it had a paper clip attached to the plug, and it sparked, and everyone screamed, and everyone was okay. But again, good to hear perspectives that everyone has a different experience. Students who did get trapped out of their spaces for a long period of time, students with their belongings left in buildings that they've been in for a period of time. Definitely a pretty traumatic experience. And fortunately, as we all are aware of, was a false scenario on Sunday, and then no loss of life or guns fired on campus here the following Tuesday. But I encourage you all to take care of yourselves and each other. Those impacts and those incidents have different effects on every person, and that there is no one answer to these challenging situations. I will say that I sit on the incident management team that talks a lot about these situations, and we did an after action report. A lot of feedback and questions around how best to address future scenarios of this. So, know that if there are questions or feedback that you have as a coach or a constituent, it's important to provide those. What can the university do to help and make those situations more understandable for folks? I know that was one of the things a lot of folks felt kind of in the dark at times, and what can the university do to improve those situations? Not on the agenda, but just wanted to know the answer. I believe that is it. We have open discussion now. If there's anyone who would like to add any open discussion.
Is it time to bring up the clock?
I'm like, wait, did we get a clock in here? Yeah, we're going to have to do something about this clock.
Buy a watch.
I got one.
Oh, so why do we need a clock?
To check my watch.
We do have some time, so I'd love to hear some engagement. What are some things that folks have on their mind as far as things that might be important for the university assembly? We had a presentation and got through all the assembly reports. These are the moments where maybe we find really great things, especially for some of the committees. looking to understand things that they could focus on.
I realize Deborah now is probably not still on here. I was gonna say something about the welfare committee, just saying that I'd love to move forward with anything related to mental health, if anyone has any interest in that. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in that always from the student assembly, as President Pollock alluded to. But yeah, I think that would be really cool.
Thank you. I recognize Caroline.
Hi, everybody. Sorry to be piping in from virtually again. I have been learning a lot about sustainability behind the scenes that I feel like the community doesn't really know about, or I didn't know about, and I'm pretty deep in it already. So, for example, did you guys know that Cornell has replaced all of its lights in all of its buildings with LED lighting and dramatically reduced emissions from lighting? So people are often saying, why can't we turn off the lights? But actually, we've already done this huge $3.2 million project to do that. And the next stage in reducing our emissions is going to call for more sacrifices. Like, they've done all the things that are low-hanging fruit. And I feel like it would be good to have a conversation about that. Like, at the moment, we're trying to propose ways of reducing and offsetting air travel. And it's frustrating. And there's a lot of pushback. But we'd like actually community engagement and community participation in that conversation. That's the working group that's on Sustainable Cornell Council, which I represent here. So anyway, I'm just wondering if it would be worth having like Sarah Berlinski from the Sustainability Office kind of talking to us about what the next steps are, what we know already, what we've done already. It's a thought for the future.
Great. Thank you, Caroline. Great perspective there. I'll recognize Emily.
Yeah, I would just say a tiny anecdote on that, and Brandon, you might actually know more about this, but today for the first time I saw signs in the dining halls encouraging students to eat plant-based food, which I don't know if like that students to eat plant-based food in the dining halls, so like to move away kind of from meat, and that was from Cornell Dining, which I don't think I've ever seen before, and so it was like encouraging students to like move towards like the more like vegetarian and vegan options, which I thought was like a good way to like kind of put that on the community as opposed to on the university, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of conversation around shifting more towards plant-based options and more sustainable. What we focus on, if you're ever interested in talking about, we use menus of change is one of our main tenets that we focus on that has a lot of the sustainability topics. Do you have something?
So I can go. I was just going to ask if there's a moment. We have one more leadership breakfast, and if anybody has any ideas, well, there's actually a whole semester. But if anybody has any ideas of topics for guests or administrators that they'd like to hear from, I'm always open to this. So.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you, Caroline. It's great to hear your voice again since last year. Did some fantastic work last year. Looking forward to more great work this year. I agree with you in terms of transportation. I think transportation is one of the biggest obstacles that this campus faces, all the way from an accessibility standpoint to a sustainability standpoint. And so that's why we're working right now with the Infrastructure, Technology, and the Environment Committee to get electric vehicle charging stations. But of course, that's only the beginning, right? How it is that we make sure that our TCAS shuttles are more efficient are actually serving the needs of the student body is really important that I'd like to look into as well. So yeah, please keep me, keep all of us in the loop, and I'd love to hear from Sarah for some additional opportunities. And with the lighting, that's awesome to hear about the LED lighting. Of course, there's a continual need for more lighting, but there are also other alternatives. I was doing some research, and you know, using reflecting materials is oftentimes also helpful in terms of traffic safety. Look at the crosswalks here; they're terribly lit. And so, from a public safety perspective, I mean, people cross jaywalk all the time. We've got to have some sort of lighting, something there. So maybe investing in some alternative measures would be an interesting proposal.
Yeah, we kind of talked, Deborah's not here now, but that was something we talked about yesterday. Like I brought it up in the wellness committee, and we were kind of like confused if that was something that the wellness committee would be able to talk about, since it's like student months or, you know, crosswalk, or if that more is like infrastructure type thing, or if that's something we could partner with that committee on, like just as far as just we can get some things like resolutions that going down the pipeline.
What specifically, the crosswalk?
Yeah, I mean, just like trying to, like, you, like specifically, like you said, like lighting crosswalks.
Yeah.
And like things like that. I mean, people speed through campus, and just different like things like that that we can do. I mean, that's a safety issue. It's a wellness issue. So I was just, you know, I guess I'm looking at you guys for like insight on what maybe we could do about that, or the proper avenue of, you know, writing something up for that, or who should do that.
It has nothing to do with sustainability, but frankly, the points you raise have been bugging me forever.
Yeah.
They really revolve around enforcement.
Exactly.
People texting and driving, and people crossing streets. And that's what you're saying. We're going to have a mass casualty event. Texting driver is going to run into a group of texting pedestrians.
Right.
And we're going to lose four or five tuition-paying students. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, it's a traffic enforcement issue. Yeah. I see too little traffic enforcement on campus. Mm-hmm. I'm riding motorcycles, so I'm very aware of the speeding and the stop sign on it. But that's not sustainable. Lighting is good, don't get me wrong, but that's not the root of the problem.
So just some comments on the lighting thing. So I have had a little bit of discussion with both the facilities and the grounds departments on the topic of increasing the lighting on campus. The feedback I've gotten essentially is the process we use for that is the annual lighting survey that we put out. And based on the fact that the lighting survey is an annual thing and has been going on for a while, I don't think that that is necessarily producing the change desired, increasing the lighting on campus. So if there was if we wanted to actually, you know, really try to make this happen, I think it would require a lot more attention from all the different bodies of the assembly, and a little bit of pressure and attention.
And like, this was something I've actually, like, I complained to Damian about this all the time, about, like, the lighting on campus, and he talked about like a specific, was it the UVA? They have like the...
Oh yeah, so we talked about the crosswalks earlier. At the University of Virginia, there are lights in the crosswalk. So then when you cross, you just press it and the whole crosswalk lights up to let the, you know, drivers know that you're coming through the crosswalk. It would be very beneficial in this main thoroughfare here, I think.
Yeah, just like that, I guess that's like a specific thing. Like the lighting story, I feel like is very, you're like very vague thing. Like, oh, put a couple more, but that would be like a specific targeted, like fixing that problem.
There may be a salt and snow issue there, but I don't know.
Good point there, Jonathan. Preston, just to answer your question, and I'll recognize Dr. Jim. As far as the committee work goes, there are times where the work it intersects in many different committee areas. You know, things that impact wellness could be addressed by the infrastructure. That doesn't mean you can't take on the conversation and the topic in the committee, and that Ian can't continue that way.
I was going to jump on that same thing. I would say I do love that idea of the lighting up the crosswalks. I've seen it, but never in New York State, so I'm curious what the issue is with maintenance. I'm not from here, obviously. So. I guess on the overlap of it, one solution that I know people often talk about, or at least this year talked about in the student assembly, is ad hoc subcommittees. So a subcommittee that could be of infrastructure and technology and wellness, or one or the other, that is a little bit more informal in that work, and also lets more community members and UA members get involved. But I don't know the logistics of that at the university assembly level. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, so as far as sustainability goes, I mean, something like this might already exist, but there's been like numerous occasions in the past, in semester two, where we're having off-campus like excursions to, you know, like Rochester or something like that, and it would be like 12 people from a class, and we'll take like 8 cars. But if there's kind of like, you know, possibility of like a, you know, informal kind of group transit kind of thing, is like, does something like that already exist within that?
We're at a stage.
Well, yeah, but like you need like a car that's big enough, and you know, because I think off often you don't have that one down, like all the people, and then probably like be the job of all the guards. What's that?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you have a driver that's certified, so if you need human, if you talk to me, anything, you can rent like the campus on stands, and I think they see that to people. So I've been on trips like locally that like take 2 man, and then we get like 600 people or something like that.
Great topic on the lighting piece there. I think there's a lot to look at that as far as, you know, the infrastructure and how that impact is on the campus at large. I think, you know, one thing to your point, Ian, if the lighting survey isn't netting the result, it sometimes takes the voice of hope to say, like, I'm a student or a faculty or staff, and I walk by this intersection every day. I see 20 people with me, and we're all in the dark as we're standing. Those kind of statements have impact, you know. Because the lighting survey is another email, right? And we're all flooded with emails and surveys, and perhaps it's time to ask the university to look at another methodology of addressing this concern, and not a survey.
The other thing was, I thought about late a few nights ago, sitting at the lights, specifically over by the law school, like 10 minutes it felt like, it probably was a few minutes, but no one's walking, and I know in my city back home, we have these smart lights, which they regulate traffic based on the intensity of movement. So they can detect where folks are, how often they're moving. And so it's a much more efficient means of transportation and regulating traffic, especially if there's nobody walking on campus, or maybe there's a lot of people walking on campus, and make sure that it is attentive to those issues of not only efficiency of transportation, but also ultimately sustainability.
So interesting, because I see people now in meetings and Zoom all the time. They're doing this in their offices because the lights go off because they don't. I don't know if other folks see that happening, but I have several folks that have really well timed out lights, and you're like talking, all of a sudden it goes dark. But you know that those sort of things do add to sustainability. Not having lights on when there's nobody there. I'm looking at those aspects. Great topic. I think definitely something for folks in the wellness as well as the infrastructure piece. So look at, you know, what can we ask of the university to address this in a different way, because it's come up several times here in the assembly, so clearly it's not there yet. So that's something we can really talk about. Any other topics for folks? I sent Jessica an email. I'll bring up something about a colleague network group that someone brought an idea up to me around, and I thought I would start throwing it out, putting it on the wall, see what the folks think about it. Around a college network group for non-native, the English, I don't know the first term, the English is not their first language, and I apologize if I don't have the nomenclature right, but we've hired 140 people in the past 6 months, and of those, probably, 5 to 8% of them don't speak English as their first language, and they're asked to learn all sorts of things and attend all sorts of online trainings and read all sorts of emails and documentation that becomes very challenging for folks. And as I try to think about from that perspective what it must be like to look at these things, we've done these exercises where we give people recipes that are written in other languages and ask them to figure it out, and they're like, oh, okay, I get it. And I have this thing that I don't understand the language of, and I'm asked to figure it out. Just a topic that I thought might be interesting to look at how the network group is supposed to be able to connect with other folks that English is not their name.
So, can I kind of done that?
Yeah.
I didn't respond to you because it struck a chord and I had to do some research. There's and I don't have the acronym in front of me because I didn't know you remember that, but there is a department in the Knight Writing Institute where they offer resources and support, and there's various groups for people who don't speak English as their first language. However, it's aimed at graduate students and international students. It's
teaching
not necessarily
assistants.
Teaching assistants, yes, thank you. So it's not necessarily for staff, but I wanted to check on that before I responded to you. But it does seem like there could be something or some way to branch out to staff. So I will send that to you tomorrow. I have a couple thoughts. But I do think something would be very, some resources, support, something would be very useful.
Yes, and, yeah, I'm just thinking from this perspective as well, like the student perspective and faculty, wondering what folks see with people who don't speak English as their first language, and if they have friends or colleagues who sometimes have those challenges of the mass amounts of communications that come to them, and how do they decipher all this.
I would also say if you're looking for people to do that, there's quite a few students on campus who are trained to be like interpreters. So I know that like they wouldn't be the form interpreters, but especially students of taking some languages or who are like learning to like read a language that they grew up with on campus, who are doing that work. And I know they do a lot of work in the law center. So I know like my friend does like helps like researchers who are interviewing people whose Spanish is their first language, even though Spanish is their second language. So that might be an opportunity to kind of talk to the students
Thank you, Emily. And so I can find that there's just a lack of knowledge of resources at times, and these are the kind of conversations we're helping to connect some of these knowledges.
Secondly, that I have a friend who's in a similar program, and I know for a lot of students who have ambitions of learning a language or simply to seek interpretation. Especially this year, given many students can't travel abroad, which is normally a very large opportunity to do language immersion. often these like work as like resume builders for a lot of students. So I know like some specific ones who work in Spanish, I think would love to talk to you about this.
Yeah. Any other open discussion? Well, I'm glad we got time for some open discussion. I mean, not closing it out, obviously. Be okay if we end a few minutes early, but I would entertain a motion to adjourn or any other conversation.
Move to adjourn.
Move to adjourn from Richard, seconded by Jacob. Seeing no objection, meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.